Flying saucers uncensored, we call this.
And they have room to soak an inch or two for air. And if it gets too stuffy back there, you might try raising one of those. It's up to you people. If you'd like to remove your jacket, but.
Flying Saucers Uncensored is what we're calling this talk, and we've pulled it together largely because of the flap, the flying saucer flap, as we called it back in August of this year. And these come periodically to arouse people's interest. This is the main reason. This is what we were told back in 1946 in Borderland Sciences Research. That it was time for a man to wake up to a little more of the hidden reality behind appearances in life. And flying saucers is one way of doing it. Someone was mentioning here, over here, talking about Alice Bailey and her work. One of the great occult teachers here in the United States, an English woman by birth, whose master teachers are Hindus, Orientals. And from the inner planes, you get this kind of mixture of racial types, but all teaching the same truth, or some aspects of truth. And one of the interesting things that Alice Bailey's teacher wrote back in the 1920s, when she was writing the treatise on cosmic fire, was that in our universe, in the larger universe, when we say the mega-universe, I think of our universe as being our own solar system. But in the galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, of which our solar system is a part, there are older evolutionary systems than ours. And this is being recognized by science. We're even talking about the percentage chance of visitors from these older systems coming here to the Earth. And I think in the current True magazine, Dr. Carl Sagan of the Harvard Observatory talking about that, and that there might be another visitation within this century. Where are these people coming from? And what is their purpose? Well, some of them, their purpose is good. They're men of goodwill, shall we say. And they would be glad to help us if we could accept their help. But there may be others also that are evil. And in this Alice Bailey book, I think it's a treatise on cosmic fire, which is a tremendous thing, perhaps over 1,000 pages of material. The Master DK does refer to two constellations which have universes like ours, which are decaying. They're burnt out. But in these systems, they have beings who are intelligent enough to have mastered space travel. But they are not good, as we would call it. And they're actually looking for a new planet on which to take up their abode. And because of their comparative superiority in science, they could dominate us, I suppose. And from our point of view, they would be troublemakers. I don't recall the constellation that Master DK named. Maybe some of you know. I'm not sure whether or not one of them was Orion. But Orion is named in the Bible. I think his symbol is the hunter in the heavens, and this could be one of the places from which these some of these visitors are coming, looking us over as a possible spot where they could bring their people and settle down. And perhaps make slaves out of us. But of course, the implication in the Master DK's material, and this in our own source of material, is that we do have races which are guarding us. We are, you might say, in the kindergarten of evolution. Or maybe we're just ready to graduate from one grade to another, and the difference between the grades is the difference between the ability to travel in space or being confined to a planet. And this is what we're doing now. We're breaking out of our confinement. So this is a very, very critical time in the period of mankind. One of the things which is so absolutely necessary to this breakout is the ability to develop and handle more power. And one of these obvious sources of power is atomic energy. But as you know, what is so critical right now in the Earth society is whether or not we'll use this atomic power in an all-out war to destroy ourselves. Or can we get along well enough to turn our technology to more constructive lines and actually learn how to travel in space? This is a testing time, and I don't know whether we can say we're going to pass the test or not. Perhaps the situation is still in the balance. But this is what we're involved in. And part of this great problem is to get people to adjust their consciousness, their understanding, to the reality of these visitors, and to be willing to accept the very humbling knowledge or information that we are not alone in the universe and that we are not tops. We're pretty far down on the evolutionary scale. And I think this is the real block, especially on the part of people in authority and those who have, with great pride, established themselves in the professional fields. It's a problem of adjusting their consciousness to the fact of the superiority of the visitors. Now, I'm not saying morally superior, but technically superior. Because obviously they have mastered space travel, and we're just beginning to find out how to do it. So they must be hundreds or even thousands of years ahead of us in evolution. Now, my personal feeling is I think it's time that our government changed its attitude on the information it has in hand and begun to release it in an intelligent way to the people of the United States. I think we have a right to it. But perhaps what is holding up a change in the silence policy is that we haven't demanded this information as voters and taxpayers. After all, who sets policy in the United States? Presumably the voters. So this is one of the things that I'm proposing on this trip. It just came to me as an idea just a few weeks ago. Suppose we flying saucer believers bombarded the presidential candidates in the 1968 campaign with a question which would go like this. If you do get into the White House, and if there is a public landing of visitors from outer space in their spaceships at Washington International Airport, would you as president go out and welcome these beings as you would welcome ambassadors from other nations on the surface of the earth? As I see it, what have we got to lose? Why don't we put this question up to the candidates that are going into the White House? We might even get one candidate to take a stand on it. And I think as a result of that, once that stand is taken, of even admitting the possibility of the reality of flying saucers or the visitors to pilot them, then we might see a change in the silence policy on flying saucers. We are going to have to initiate it, because the presidents are not initiating it. And when Eisenhower was asked about flying saucers back in 54 or whenever it was, he said, he implied that we're looking to the Air Force for the answers on this. But the Air Force doesn't set policy in the United States. The Air Force is just carrying out the orders of somebody who is in the civilian level in the government, who says, let us hold it, let us suppress this information, because it's too dangerous to let out. Dangerous to whom? Dangerous to some vested interest in our society who is afraid they'll lose a few billion dollars? I think that's the real reason for the silence policy. And if that policy is going to be changed, we are the ones who are going to have to change it. And as long as we sit on our hands and wait for authorities to move, they won't move. Because they haven't moved since 1947. Because the saucers have been present in our sky since then in a public way. 18 years, and still no voice of authority in Washington or anywhere else standing up and saying, This planet is under observation. We are not alone in the universe. And yet we know beyond any shadow of a doubt that tangible proof is in the hands of our authorities. I'm going to show you some flying saucer pictures here tonight, which have been taken by amateurs. And if we have evidence this good, what about the evidence the Air Force has in its files where it has men on duty 24 hours a day all over the earth with the best scientific equipment? So when an Air Force release says we have no physical evidence of their reality, this is a lie. A bold-faced lie, because it just is not true. Now, I'll give you an example of it right here. On December 16, 1954, a torpedo-shaped spaceship, bigger than the B-29 bomber fuselage, no wings, appeared over Apple Valley Inn on the high desert, Victorville, California, about 150 miles from Los Angeles, and only 4 miles away from George Air Force Base, one of the jet training bases of the United States Air Force. And this flying saucer appeared at 24,000 feet, about 24,000 feet above Apple Valley Inn, about 6 o'clock on the night of December 16th. Now, down on the ground, the sun had set, but up at that altitude, it was still shining, and this was shining on this torpedo-shaped, gleaming spaceship, which was stationary in the sky. We didn't have any equipment then, and I don't believe we have anything today which could hover that long at 24,000 feet. I don't believe our helicopters would go that high. And there were 50 guests there at the Apple Valley Inn. They all saw it. Hart T. Goodman, who gave this excellent report, a former Air Force pilot himself in World War II, a pilot of B-29 bombers, a trained observer, watched this thing through binoculars, and he could see a row of portholes along the side. Finally, the sun went down, and darkness came on, even at those altitudes. And this thing didn't disappear in the darkness because it began to glow red, and it stayed there, glowing that way all night long. And it was still there until noon the next day. 18 hours, this UFO hovered in the sky there, motionless, only 4 miles from this George Air Force Base and above Apple Valley Inn. Goodman said that he could see the contrails of jet planes flying around it, even 10,000 feet higher. The Air Force had ample time to take thousands of feet of motion pictures of this thing, if they wanted to. And the citizens, the civilians that there at George Air Force, at Apple Valley Inn, called George Air Force Base to ask about this, going to authority for answers. And the people at the Air Force Base wouldn't even admit that the UFO was there. They couldn't. Their regulations forbid it. Joint Army Navy Air Force Publication 200-2 says specifically that if the object is a UFO, if you can't explain it as a natural object or some natural phenomenon, don't say anything. That has been in effect for years, and it's still in effect. Who is going to change it? If anybody is, we are. We're going to have to change it. That's for sure. Hart Goodman went back to Los Angeles, called Paul Coates, who had his TV interview program at the time, told him about the sighting. Coates was skeptical, but he got excited enough to go up to Apple Valley Inn and interview some of the guests who were still there who had seen it, also the manager and the cook. And he found a couple of sergeants from the Air Force Base who were willing to admit that there had been this UFO up in the sky. Went back to Los Angeles and went over his notes, called Apple Valley Inn, and wanted to talk to the two Air Force sergeants again, found that they'd suddenly gone back to the base. They were incommunicado. But Coates did confirm Goodman's story by talking to enough other people who had seen this UFO to know that it was a fact. Now, years earlier, 1948, Air Force pilots were willing to talk about sightings. Policy hadn't become so set then. Here's one that I cut out of the Honolulu Star Bulletin because I was living in Honolulu at the time. But this report was in the United Press from Mitchell Field on Long Island, New York. Two Air Force jet pilots reported today, this was September 11th, 1948. They chased a mysterious round flying object traveling at a speed they estimated at 900 miles an hour, or 30 miles, and couldn't catch it. No Air Force pilot today would even admit that this had happened to him. But it is happening. It's still going on. Wilbur Rogers of Columbia, PA, told Mitchell Field authorities he and Captain Edward Ballard of Dover, Delaware, sighted the object yesterday over Sandy Hook, New Jersey, while they were on a routine training flight in the T-33 jet. I don't know if it was a flying saucer, but it sure was something I've never seen before. We couldn't have caught it in an F-86 Sabre jet. He said it was white or silver colored and was about the size of a fighter plane. They were flying along at 450 miles an hour, 20,000 feet. So then, of course, there's this famous admission by Commander Robert McLaughlin of the United States Navy in that story in True Magazine, which was published in 1950. And in 1949, he had tracked flying saucers with a theodolite at White Sands Proving Ground there in New Mexico, tracking our earliest missiles and weather balloons. And his famous statement, "I am convinced that they are spaceships from another planet operated by animate, intelligent beings." And I'm quite sure from my own observation and experience that this is still true, and I believe you would say the same thing. But there hasn't been any change in the flying saucer phenomenon since that time, except that there's perhaps an increase in sightings. This August 3rd flap is all over the world, apparently. Simultaneous sightings in cities in the United States, Europe, South America, Honolulu. Here's one more from out of the dim and distant past. This was published in the Victoria, B.C. Daily Times, July 24th, 1948. Huge, wingless, two-deck plane proves a mystery. And two Eastern Airline pilots were on a flight between Montgomery, Alabama and Atlanta, Georgia, Childs and Whitted, flying along at 5,000 feet. And here this huge torpedo-shaped spaceship came flying along at the same altitude, just a mile or two away, blazing with light. No wings. I'll show you a slide copy of Childs' drawing of what it looked like, a needle-nosed torpedo-shaped spaceship with a huge jet exhaust coming out the back of it. Nothing particularly new, but here you have two reliable observers, of course, reporting what they saw. And needless to say, they weren't grounded when they got to Atlanta and told their story. They were closely questioned. How did we get our information on saucers? We got it through a medium in San Diego. Meade Lane, the founder of our organization, had a young man named Mark Probert come to him who was having unusual psychic experiences. He'd go into trance, and then he would speak in foreign tongues, Oriental and European. And he wanted to know what was happening to him. This is normal, I guess. Anyone should be curious. No one could tell him. He heard of Meade Lane, who was a student of occult sciences and metaphysics. He came up to Meade's home in San Diego and told Meade what was happening to him. And then he went on into trance there, and the phenomenon reoccurred. And Meade realized that this looked like a very exceptional form of mediumship. This was in about August 1946. And a couple of months later, this was no coincidence, I don't think. A huge black torpedo-shaped spaceship appeared over San Diego on the night of October 9th, 1946. We didn't call them flying saucers then. People there in San Diego who saw it thought it might have been a Navy dirigible operating in the area without motors and without lights. The reason so many people saw it that night, there were many amateur astronomers out for the Jacobi Zinner comet shower of meteorites looking up into the skies. Meade put an ad in the San Diego paper a day later wanting contact with anyone who saw this, and he got 40 replies, and they were all positive. They didn't agree in their analysis of what they saw, but they saw something. So he can see, in fact, Mark Probert was one of the witnesses, the medium. Well, we'll need to ask to have the next seance session through Mark Forward and talking to the controls. This is what they said. This was a visitor from outer space. You are under observation. And you'll probably see more of these things because you are ready for this kind of information now. I think there are some people here in the United States who wouldn't agree with that. Whether we're ready or not, they're here and they're appearing in our skies, that's for sure. I'd like to give you the verbatim remarks of one of the controls, Charles Linkford. This was in July 1947, a year after we got our, almost a year after we got our, what we call our 4D interpretation of the spaceships. And about a month after, Ken Arnold saw the nine saucers flying in front of Mount Rainier over here on June 24th, 1947. Lindbergh said, in the course of time, you'll find that these flying saucers will tell their own story. You know from your reading and study that there have been many such phenomena. Just now, you're having them in large numbers and over a wide region because the world is, in a sense, ready for them. All you need now is to be pushed a little bit and you'll wake up. Well, I don't believe that the majority of Americans really are awake yet to this. Perhaps if our government had set out with a positive program of education in 1947, we would be awakened. But we're still waiting for the voice of authority. But what authority is going to give us the psychic interpretation of the saucers? This is about what it comes down to. Lindbergh said, you suppose for a moment that any actual material thing, such as you know, could rip and tear across the sky without burning up? I don't mean to say that these are not material, but the material is such it can stand the heat and the speed. And then someone said, well, does this construction material exist in our physical plane as an alloy? And Lindbergh, yes, a kind of an alloy. There may be more of these flying saucers, and there'll be various kinds. But the flying saucers come from a condition or state from which we would call the etheric. And this is a sort of a left-handed scientific term that came out in the 19th century. I think Sir Oliver Lodge was one of the ones who was responsible for it because he had also heard about the etheric levels through mediumship. An all-pervasive fluid medium, which is invisible to normal sight and touch. They're quite real. And then someone said, is there any relation between flying saucers and the things which have fallen to Earth? Lindbergh said, there are various ways of running things by remote control other than you know of. There are energies yet unknown to science. There are etheric dwellers who have not known physical life. I am referring to your flying saucers. They come out of that plane of existence. A materialization and a dematerialization. Someone said, do the disks carry a crew? Well, the large ones, yes. The small ones, no. These are controlled from the craft that carry a crew. Some of these remote control disks break away from control and then become limp like paper and vanish. Well, this is fortunate for us. There's a lot of hardware operating up there. If it came down solid, it might crash into somebody or something and destroy it. It's very thoughtful of them to cause their ships to dematerialize. But, of course, this also leaves no evidence of their presence, doesn't it? And this is one of the points some scientists have made, that if they are flying through our skies, some of their equipment is bound to fail just as ours fails, and it would come down. Yes, it would, if it weren't made of negative matter. I suppose all the controls do up above there is collapse the magnetic field which holds the physical matter together and it just turns to dust and falls to dirt undetected. And this has happened many times. There was this blazing torpedo-shaped object which flew in from the ocean across the South Island of New Zealand back in 1955 at tremendous speed, and thousands of people saw it because it was only 100 or 200 feet underground. Went on inland toward Inchbonnie, and just before it ran into the mountain range there, it exploded with a roar which was heard for 100 miles, and there was this great cloud of dust and smoke there in the sky. If they hadn't seen it, they certainly heard it. And the authorities went to the area where this thing, where the debris should have fallen to Earth, And they didn't find nothing. That's kind of tough, isn't it? And then there's the experience of the Philadelphia policeman. On the night of October 1st, 1951, on patrol in the suburbs of that city, the city of brotherly love. And here was this glowing object floating gently down through the twilight sky, came to earth in a vacant lot, fairly close to the street. So the patrolman parked their patrol car and got out and radioed back to headquarters that they had this UFO under observation and would stay there until they saw what happened or whatever. And it was about 4 feet high, 6 feet across, of just a massive material, and it was glowing faintly, as ectoplasm glows in the seance room under certain conditions. Walked over to it, shined their flashlights on it, no sound, no nothing. Finally, Patrolman Collins put his hand out, finger, and touched this massive stuff, and his finger went into it just as though it were jelly. I don't know whether it had a feeling of wetness or not. But they didn't have to wait long there. Within 20 minutes, this mass of material had just gradually shrunk away on the ground until it disappeared. Now, isn't that a nice piece of data for a technician to puzzle over? What are you going to make of that? But here you have the factual report of four policemen, each confirming the other's story. This is what we saw. But this kind of backs up what Linkford said in 1947, 4 years earlier, that those that get out of control, I suppose the saucer people consider that they're what we would say expendable. They don't bother to bring them back. They just collapse the field and let it go on, disintegrate. And someone said then, you know, about this becoming limp like paper and vanishing. Do they return to the etheric? He said, yeah. Well, if they don't return to another rate of vibration, the energy goes back to its primal state. The remote control discs lose their identity. This explains what happens to those saucers that appear to land but cannot be found. The force and the structure disintegrate. And someone said, well, suppose they have a crew aboard. What happens to the crew? Well, if there are beings in a disc which disintegrates, they simply go back to the etheric world from which they emerged. But we do something like this too when we die. We come from the astral plane and we return to it and allow our bodies to disintegrate too. But because we don't know this very well, we fear death. We think it's something terrible. But actually, it may be a blessing, man. You thankfully go back. Get out of the rat race here or the insane asylum. We're all committed to this institution. Then someone said, well, are we going to get the truth from our authorities? No, said Lingford, you'll get no information from your higher-ups. Well, there seems to have been a lull in the sightings lately. Have the spaceships been withdrawn from the Earth? No, they are not being withdrawn. They are just being explained away. However, the flying saucers will carry on until explanations run out and people become curious again. Then they have another flying saucer flap like we had in August. Then someone said, well, there hadn't been any reports for several days. And Linkford said, well, they've just shifted their field of operations. They have to cover the Earth, you know. There's a reason for everything, and I believe one reason for the disc is to show the people of the world that there are ways of traveling faster and eliminating friction. The visitors may even allow one or two of these things to land so that they can be examined and experimented on. In that way, you will find out how to build such craft that will travel out into space, and maybe you can find a new planet on which to start a war. And someone shrewdly observed, well, maybe we'll be forced to leave this one. Oh, yes. I believe man will abandon this planet, but not for many years to come. Nature is vast, and man fits in as a part of it. He may try to destroy himself, but he will be unsuccessful, and that will make him unhappy. Time will come, and science knows that whenever the human race hopes to survive, it will have to survive on another planet. Then someone said, well, do you recognize the presence of etheric planets or invisible planets? You said, well, yes, there are etheric planets, and there are gaseous planets that are just forming into solids. New ones are made all the time. And he said, you know, I'm getting tired. The trouble in my world is the same as in yours. a great deal of talk and nothing really satisfactory. You will find that condition in all worlds and in all states of consciousness. Someone said, what? Is there no heaven, Lindbergh? No. If there is, you wouldn't be happy there. Without boredom, there would be a state of inertia. Man must be unhappy in order to exist. Anybody agree with that? The moment he becomes perfectly happy, he becomes non-existent. You reach a state of perfect balance, which might be the absolute, compare it to absolute. And then your consciousness would shift to another level. Some time ago, one of the other controls hinted that man was an awesome creature in many ways. I could never begin to tell you how awesome he really is. Horror upon horror is in him, and beauty beyond conception also. Man's many-sidedness is appalling. I want to add about the flying saucers. We haven't given you any wrong information. The predictions of that woman about the discs being of Russian origin are incorrect. There is no new information about saucers at present, but the Russian source is ridiculous. I do know that the flying saucers come from the etheric world, from the invisible, and they return to it. And the controls have insisted now for 18 years that there is no physical travel, really, between the planets. It isn't necessary. There's a conversion of energy in deep space to what we might call pure thought. And then a reconversion in the region of the planet you want to visit. Come back down the scale of tangibility. Dr. Hubertus Strughold has hinted something like this. You know, he's in the thick of the space race there at NASA headquarters in Houston. He was pictured with Dr. Barry during the last Gemini 5 flights. Strughold, I believe, is a German-American scientist. And some years ago in a public lecture, he said that it might be that we wouldn't have to take huge quantities of air and water and food on the deep space voyages because there's no time involved in getting to Mars or Venus. It'll be practically instantaneous once they leave the region of the Earth, or once they've left it. Well, what about this other prediction of Lingford's there in 1947, that the visitors would allow some of their craft to land so our scientists could puzzle over them? One such craft came down on the Spitsbergen Islands in the Arctic Ocean, north of Norway, Russia, July of 1952. And planes of the Norwegian Air Force saw this thing in the skies and followed it down. Crashed there at Spitsbergen. Apparently there was no crew aboard. The remains of this thing were taken to Narvik, Norway, and the Norwegian General Staff organized a board of inquiry to look at this thing and decide who and what and where it had been made. 3 years later, on September 4th, 1955, in Oslo, Norway, Colonel Gernot Darnbile of the Norwegian General Staff made a public release on it. Crashing of the Spitsbergen disk was highly important. I am confident that these remains from Spitsbergen will prove to be of great importance. Some time ago, a misunderstanding was caused by saying that the disk probably was of Soviet origin. He said, I wish to state emphatically this is not so. This has not been built in any country on Earth. The materials used in its construction are completely unknown to all experts having participated in the investigation, and at any rate, only to be obtained after physical and chemical processes still unknown to us. And then he went on to say that this information would be shared with British and United States governments because it was so highly important. So if nothing else, I suppose that our government has the official report of the Norwegian Air Force Board of Inquiry on this thing. Probably pictures. We might have even sent an observer over there to see this. As far as I know, the Norwegian government still has it. There's no reason why not. But there's another interesting interview in this same news item with Lieutenant Tillinson of the Norwegian Air Force, who said, I think the Arctic is serving as a base for the unknowns, especially during snowstorms when we are being forced back to our bases by unpleasant weather. In my opinion, the flying discs take this opportunity to land. shortly after such adverse weather conditions, I have seen them land and take off on 3 separate occasions. And by the way, in our slides, you'll see the photograph of 2 glowing disks flying over Norway in 1954, taken by Norwegian photographers while this plane was up there to get photos of the eclipse of the sun that summer. And more confirmation of Lingford's statement that these ships would be allowed to land so our scientists could examine them. In January of 1954, Frank Edwards, the radio announcer on ABC, said that he had had word from California that the Air Force had a captured flying saucer in its possession. And then on April 16th, the director of our organization at that time, the founder of it also, Mead Lane, received a letter from one of our associates, who said, "I have just returned from Yurok." Yurok Dry Lake is where Edwards Air Force Base, there on the California desert. The report is true. That is the report of captured or landed flying saucers. I made the trip up there with F.A. of the Hearst Papers, E.N. of the Brookings Institute, and Bishop M. of Los Angeles. They were allowed to enter the restricted section at Edwards Air Force Base after 6 hours of examining their credentials and swearing them to secrecy under the security laws and so on. And I had the distinct feeling that the world had come to an end with fantastic realism. For I have never seen so many human beings in a state of complete collapse and confusion as they realized that their own world had indeed ended, all their treasured ideas and so on. He said he saw at least 5 flying saucers or spaceships sitting on the runway, and a host of scientists and people in other walks of life in the United States and elsewhere, economists, sociologists, congressmen, and so on, invited out there by the Air Force, sworn to secrecy and then allowed on the field to see these things. And apparently they were there for several months. In fact, I have heard on this trip that one spaceship, at least, is still locked up in a top secret hangar there at Edwards Air Force Base. And the reaction of these authorities. Our associate said, "In some instances, I could not stifle a wave of pity that arose as I watched the pathetic bewilderment of brilliant brains struggling to make some sort of rational explanation which would enable them to retain their familiar theories and concepts." And he said he thanked his own destiny that he had got lost in the metaphysical woods years early and found his way out. And so had adjusted his consciousness to the idea of other worlds, other planes of consciousness, and the possibility of materialization and dematerialization, which is what the scientists are going to have to come to. Because when you conquer gravity, you conquer time, and if your control is right, you can disappear just like that. And I hope most of you here saw the dramatization in movies of H.G. Wells' The Time Machine. Because there it was portrayed very clearly, regardless of whether you could understand it or not. But H.G. Wells had it right. The idea of speeding up the vibratory rate to where the material becomes crystalline, translucent, and light can come right through it. So you're seeing through it because you can see objects on the other side of where this thing was. And this is what was done for the scientists there at Edwards Air Force Base. Time and time again, the pilots of these things caused them to disappear while they were sitting on the runway. And the scientists could see through them. This is what nearly caused them to crack up. And I suppose they walked over there and they could feel this crystalline structure, just like you feel plate glass. You see, it's still solid, but it's translucent. And then the pilots would cause the vibratory rate to go even higher on the scale of tangibility. And then the scientists could walk right across the runway. And then they cleared the area, and these things were caused to materialize again. This was done many times, so that there was no shadow of a doubt in the mind of our authorities that this could be done. And this is what caused them, that maybe some of them did crack up. I wouldn't blame them. I remember Dan Fry saying in one of his lectures a few years ago, talking about arguing with one of our space age scientists in California, who just couldn't believe in flying saucers. So Dan said, well, you know, let's open it up. Dan said, well, suppose a flying saucer landed on your lawn. The scientist said, I still wouldn't believe it. And you run into people like this. Because they can't change. They don't want to change. They're satisfied with things the way they are. But the visitors aren't going to allow us to be satisfied. We've developed the atomic bomb. So it's time that we develop the moral responsibility which goes along with it. Oh. This associate also wrote, President Eisenhower, as you may know, was spirited over to Burak one night. We'll have to brace this, I guess, and go over too much, yeah. President Eisenhower was spirited over to Edwards Air Force Base from Palm Springs. And the president did have his vacation there at Palm Springs in March of 1954. And for 4 hours on a Saturday night, he did disappear from Palm Springs, and the press went crazy trying to find out where he was. The Associated Press representative there actually put on the private wire to New York that Eisenhower had been assassinated. And when the Air Force press officers or the press have found this out, they had to admit that the president hadn't been killed, even though they couldn't say where he had gone. But he was flown to Muroc, though he didn't go out on the field. They were afraid that he might be kidnapped, perhaps. But he had no doubt about the reality of the visitors, I'm sure of that. And, as the associate said, it is my conviction that the president will ignore the terrific conflict between the various authorities and go directly to the people via radio and television. If the impasse continues much longer. From what I could gather, an official statement to the country is being prepared for delivery about the middle of May. The president could not resolve the conflict between the various authorities there as to what could be told the people. So, as you know very well, he said nothing. That was April 16th, 1954, that our director received this letter and the staggering information which he could scarcely believe himself. So the next day he went over to Mark Robert's apartment and with the idea or the hope that he could talk to one of the inner circle through Mark. And Mark went into trance and Ramon Natale took over, the Italian scientist of the group who concerns himself with scientific subjects. And Meade asked if he should publish this information, and Natale advised him, let, he said, let it come out through someone else than you. But if you want to make a limited release to some of the hand-picked associates, that would be all right. So I did get this personal bulletin in Honolulu about this landing, which I couldn't believe either. Because at that time I hadn't made up my own mind about the reality of the visitors. Then, Associate Francis Ohm asked Ramon, do you feel, Ramon, that Eisenhower is sincere in his attempt and what he might try to do and his pressure put on him, or what? And Natale replied, this man, like all men of his kind in high government positions, is the leader or a symbol of such in your country. They are always under pressure. They cannot act alone. Back of him in the shadows stand such individuals as Bernard Baruch and some of the high...